Recording in progress.
Okay, I want to thank the lady for enabling me to continue and has given me the good word. I want to thank everyone. I haven't had such a big class since Corona began. And I want to say hello to everyone on the screen. Today we're recording, we're doing everything right. Today is Monday, December 27th, 2021. And here we are in Yerushalayim. I've already gotten emails on yesterday's Shia, and I just want, this is for you, and I just want to state one thing, that I got an email from David Newman from Cleveland. He's related to Vic Snow, and dealing with the halacha of sports and everything I said, and I totally agree with him. In other words, halachically, you can work out, you can play table tennis, chveis. You can make a whole case as long as the ground is paved over and you're not uprooting anything. But the problem is the spirit of Shabbat. And that's why I can tell you Rav Avadya's psak, which evidently the no one would me, that Balei Tshuva from the soccer world, and they want to continue playing on Shabbos, and he paskind as long as you don't ride to where you're playing, you're nearby, you can walk over, b'di'eved, it's not a halacha lachatchila, but b'di'eved, but if we allow the kids to play basketball on Shabbat, and they play, you know, it's a real game, and they keep score, where's the spirit of Shabbat? And I agree with Rabbi Shapiro wholeheartedly when he was all upset in North Hollywood that Shabbat afternoon. I agree with him wholeheartedly, and I agree with David Newman, the Kalev HaChassid in Cleveland. We're on the same wavelength. I just want to mention, again, no one bothers to consult me. I'm alive and kicking, despite the fact that everyone I ever knew is going or gone already. Today is Rabbi Dulitz's funeral. Did you have Rabbi Dulitz as a Rebbe? You knew him. Everyone knew Label. It couldn't be you went to MTA and you didn't know Label. It hurts, it hurts. But all right, this is life, and Baruch Hashem, some of us are still alive and kicking. So on the Sforim blog, they published memories of Rav Aaron Kotler of Lakewood in its early years. Shmayahu Shulman, Rabbi Shmayahu Shulman, who was known as Shmeru to all his friends, and again, you see the Haredi influence, they can't deal with the real world. There's a whole back and forth correspondence here. Was his name really Shmeru? What do you think? We were born Harav HaGon, Aaron Rakefet. I was born Ani Rothkopf, and basically I still remain Ani Rothkopf. Chas v'chalila, I should take anything else seriously. His name was Shmeru, and he was a gonadir, and he was an interesting individual because he was somewhere between RCA and a good Tarabonim, and in my time he was well known, published a great deal. So he gives certain recollections of Lakewood. I just want to state that he claims that the only one who understood Reb Aaron Shear was Reb Moshe Eisenman. Okay. I have to tell you, Reb Moshe Eisenman, there were two Moshe Eisenmans in Lakewood in my time, and people ask, and it's very simple. The elder Reb Moshe Eisenman, who was, as far as I recall, an uncle to the younger Reb Moshe Eisenman, was a Kletzke. He was Reb Aaron's Talmud from Kletz. His nephew, who later goes on to teach in Baltimore, I'm sure your brother knows Moshe Eisenman from Ne Yisrael in Baltimore, that was a nephew. The uncle was Taka, one of the greatest Talmidim of Reb Aaron. Later went in, if I recall, to Vineland. There was a yeshiva organized in Vineland. He was the Rosh Yeshiva. But I have to tell you, there were more people who understood Reb Aaron. He wasn't the only Kletzke there. There were a few others. And then there was an American boy, I think, born, bred in the Bronx, Yankel Schiff. Yankel Schiff understood Reb Aaron as good as anyone. When the Shear was over, guys like us would make an appointment to talk with Reb Yankel about the Shear, because we understood the first 10 minutes, 12 minutes. He wasn't like the Rebbe. We spoke about this many times. The Rebbe said, when Reb Aaron died, the difference between me and Reb Aaron is I tried to make my shiur understandable to everyone. I don't know to everyone, but the Rebbe certainly made an effort to, he repeated, he clarified. Reb Aaron was hail, fire, and brimstone, and he ran. And at the end of 10, 20 minutes, only the greatest understood him. So we used to talk and learning with Reb Yankel Schiff, okay? So that's just to clarify, I wouldn't say that Reb Moshe Eisman Sr. was the only one. And the relationship, as far as I recall, was uncle to nephew. If anyone wants this, it's Reb Shmaier's memoir, you're welcome to it. The book I quoted, and I thank Dr. Marty Lipson and Eleanor in Toronto, the title of the book, Where Canada Closed Its Gates During World War II, is None Is Too Many. Canada and the Jews of Europe, 1933-1948, by Harold Roper and Irvin Abella. Also, I want to mention, we got involved with the Satmar Ruv in when he already was in Satmar. The difference between his talks and the big Ashkenazi shul, where he encourages them to wear shaitels, and his talks to his Satmar Chassidim, where he rips the heck out of shaitels, totally, completely asa. And that got us involved in the whole question, who is the real Rambam? And, anyone who's a master of the Rambam, both philosophically and halachically, and the letters, the Igrot, who is the real Rambam? And I took you back. I said, I live this dichotomy. I often used to think about it in the 60s. Here I was a Rosh Yeshiva in YU, and I was giving my students hell to become Gedolei Torah. And then I go back to the rabbinate and organizing an Orthodox shul without even a minion of... And I would speak to the sisterhood and speak to the men's club. It wasn't called the Brotherhood yet. And, believe me, I didn't demand from them what I would like to see my students at. I remember one time a father came to me, and, when you had open teachers, parents, whatever... And a father says to me, "Oh, my son is." Most of my students in the 60s were second generation. In other words, I was teaching kids, as I told you, in BMT in the early 70s on Rehovah Babanel 24. I gave an entire shiur in Yiddish. I remember it like today. If I'm not mistaken, I have a recording of it, a tape. It was on Slabotka Musa. And everyone understood Yiddish. It was a different world. And I remember this father says to me, "My son is tzifrim, the kid is too religious." So I said to him, "What are your complaints?" And he tells me this. I said, "All right, I would rate him, he's 120%. But in 10 years, he's going to be out of the yeshiva, out of the Torah, he's going to be in business, whatever." All the kids then became medical doctors. I said, "He's going to lose some of it. Let him lose 20%, that remain 100%. Then if he's 100%, then he goes down to 80. And the father embraced me. He was so happy with my answer. He said, "Don't complain about that." So there's no question that we have to know who we're making demands from. The same thing with the example yesterday in class. And you see, Reb Menashe Klein... It doesn't ask the sports, but you wind up a kid on Shabbos. There'll be no Shabbos left. Who are you talking to? If someone comes to me from Gris Kolel and says, "Can I play ball on Shabbos?" The answer is no. You have one day a week to devote to total spirituality. But Rabbi Vartya is dealing with a Baal Tshuva who doesn't want to ride on Shabbos, doesn't want to write. But he's Nebuch, he's in the league, and he wants to go up and up in the league. So that's what they say, he was Mati, and that's what the kid from Woodmere, who got a minor league contract or whatever, he already will show up on Shabbos to play. He won't drive, but the play, he'll play. The other kid from the California area, I think it's the San Francisco area, the valley, that area, he already became from, his father, I understand, became through Chabad, And that kid already, he's only dreaming of being a catcher or a pitcher. Because all of you know that a catcher can't catch 7 straight days. It's the most exhausting job in baseball. And a pitcher, every 4 days, every 5 days. So you can work it out around Shabbat. Now, I got a wonderful email from my Talmud, Dr. Alan Blau. And it's nothing to do with Satmar. He works for Satmar. He's in charge of their psychological services. But he said on this topic of we're two different people, he said the Rav was two different people. And he quotes his father from publication in Chakira. I asked him today to send me the links to what his father published. You got to know, his father's Robert Blau, Bobby Blau. Bobby Blau was a Talmud Mufak of the Rav in the 40s. Mamish a Talmud Mufak. That's when the Rav not only taught in yeshiva, but he taught in Bernard Revel Graduate School. So now Chakir is publishing his notes from Bernard Revel Graduate School. They're editing him and publishing them. I looked at some of it. I couldn't understand the word. The philosophy is beyond me. But maybe at my age, I have a psychological block. Our Jewish philosophy. I saw the mirror. I saw Talmidim of Reuven Lvovitz. I don't need the philosophy. But he says, his father wrote that how the Rav was two different people. The Rav at Rebbe was Dr. Soloveitchik, preeminent scholar and lecturer. At Rebbe, the Rav would welcome any remark or question related to the lecture. In fact, he seemed to invite these introductions as an opportunity for further clarification. His manner at these lectures was always cordial and pleasant. By contrast, across the street at Reitz, in my time, what he's talking about, Revel was a little building. Charlie, do you remember that? Before your time, too. In my time, in the 51, I came to YU, Revel was a little building built by the government with money for the veterans. And it was a little building, a little hut on Amsterdam Avenue. Across the street was Reitz, was the big building, the Beis Medrash. At Reitz, a very different move prevailed. There the Rav was strict and demanding, clarity and credibility with the order of the day. Meteorocracy and shallowness were unacceptable. Slouchedness and thinking, deplorable. The Rav would not abide impromptu guesswork. The student had to know exactly what he was trying to say. And I think that this description hit the nail on the head. And I can tell you, unfortunately, the Rav mellowed later in life. I mellowed very quickly. My first rabbinate had a share, and coming in Ali on the boat, I was a terror. Do you remember what the board was? I gave tests, and I was a Rebbe, and you've got to know and shape up. And Joey Epstein once got an 85 on one of my tests. He called his father, the rabbi of Syracuse, in joy. I got that, got to Israel. I never gave a test again in my life. And then, I had a problem because other teachers would complain, everyone loves Rakefet. He never gives the test. I would say, write a paper, who I am, what I say. So the truth is I couldn't give tests because the boat trip was about from New York. We left on June 26th. We arrived in Israel. We docked July 5th. Every day you became more humble. The thought that I, Ani Rothkopf, who survived assimilation in America with miracles, because most of my family is totally gone. None Jews, none parent, no children. My brother said we have first cousins who declared they would never have children, bring them into this terrible world. I don't know. I have so many great-grandchildren, and they're the greatest joy in life to watch them, to see them. Wow, without children, what do we have? When all is said and done, that's what we're proudest of. They asked Aaron Lichtman, Reb Aaron, what are you proudest of your life? And he answered, the family I raised. I understand them 100%. So that boat ride humbled me. the Rav, unfortunately, old age and illness. And if you saw the documentary, I was privileged to bring into the world, The Lonely Man of Faith. So there, they interview Aaron Rabbi pardon me for not using titles, these are all my contemporaries. And as I've often said, people say, Rabbi Kefet, I say, people who I don't know, I say, I'm Aaron Rekefet, I wasn't born with any title. But Aaron Adler said he couldn't believe it. In one shiur in the 70s, a guy said Narishkeit, and Chaim Soloveitchik, my classmate, Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, came back from Israel to help take care of his father. And Chaim turns to Aaron Adler and says, boy, since when does my father tolerate such Narishkeit? And Enochinami, in Bobby Blau's time, in my time, I was once called, you know that, I was called the Reform Rabbi. I gave a svara, and the Rabbi, we have it on recording. I played it to the Kollel years ago, and they found it. Arnold, what are you, a Reformed Rabbi? And no one defended me. The whole class is laughing, and no one defended me. But the Rabbi, but he mellowed so, tying it in with yesterday's shiur, that in the 70s, there was a Sunday, what's it, Super Sunday it's called? Super Bowl, what's it called? Super Sunday? I'm not a football fan, so I don't know. Super Sunday. And the kids were very restless. It was in first hall. And the shiur is going on, and the Rebbe is struggling with the Gemara. I think it was Baba Batra. And finally he looks around and he says, all right, go see the game on television. We'll continue tomorrow. So, all right, that's life. All right, now we got to get very serious, unfortunately. So we left the Satma Rav. By the way, I've been criticized. Why am I teaching about Satma? I don't believe in him. I oppose him. Oh, that man, he did this wrong and that wrong. So I only have to tell you, I don't believe in Satma either. And I'll get to his thinking, and I told you the final shiur, a year from now, I'll be able to refute him in 5 minutes with one major source. But that's not the point. Rakefet Kamandaviz, how do you translate that? I don't even know. Kamandaviz, that art scroll is intellectually dishonest. And my greatest proof is that the man, the first person to build Torah in America, my blood cousin, which I found out decades after I wrote my book, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel. You open up Art Scroll publications, you can get sick if you know the truth and see what they write. Mr. Mendelovich was wonderful, but he stood on the shoulders of, as I showed you from Mr. Mendelovich's writings, of Dov Revel. But all right, they don't like the way why you turned out, why you doesn't exist, why you's not religious, why you's not that. In the meantime, why you turned out some real Gedolei Torah. I don't have to go further. In the building, at least until 9 o'clock, was Reb Heschel Schechter. No, I don't have to go further. So not to do the Satmar is intellectually dishonest, because the Satmar until today has had tremendous influence in America. All I can tell you is the Rav could never swing an election in the United States. The Satmar Rabbeim can swing an election. V'day l'chakima b'remisa. Adams, the new mayor of New York, I was about to say Eric Davis, I had in this building in BMT in the 80s, I had a top student, Eric Davis, one of the most famous baseball players was Eric Davis, the outfield. I think he was the Cincinnati Reds. So Eric Adams just appeared, as we will see, at the Satmar dinner, giving thanks to God for saving the Satmar Rav. So you have to be intellectually honest. Satmar Rav, what he did in America, against all odds, you have to stand in awe. Whether we agree or disagree is a different story. But Satmar's here to stay, and I'm proud to tell you I have students in Satmar as well. And last year we actually had a Satmar chassid in the class. Not the first YU guy from Satmar, but the first in Gris Kollel to wear a Shtreimel and a Bekesher on Shabbos. And a wonderful student sitting right where you're sitting, Natan. Now, so the Satmar Rav is saved by the Kastner train. The Kastner train opens a tremendous halachic question and many emotional issues that we have not been able to solve until today. Now, let's give the facts first. The Kastner train consisted of 35 cattle cars, which left Budapest the 30th of June, 1944. This was already when the Germans occupied Hungary, and it took approximately 1,600 Jews to safety, ultimately reaching Switzerland. In order to save these Jews, Kastner negotiated with Adolf Eichmann and his underlings, and there was a tremendous amount of gold, diamonds, cash paid to save these Jews. The passengers were chosen from a wide range of social class. There were wealthy Jews, there were poor Jews, there were religious Jews, there were Haredi Jews, there were Zionist Jews, there were Mizrahi Zionists, there were secular Jews. As I've stated so many times, Kastner later explained, he thought in terms of Noah's Ark. What does Noah's Ark represent? Creation, as creation was before the flood, we will recreate the world after the flood. Two of each species, at least the not kosher species, after the other ones, seven of each species, etc. But multifaceted, multicolored, multi-rainbow, call it what you wish. Now, he also included on the train his own immediate family. His father-in-law, who was the head of the Zionist movement in Hungary, or at least I should say the what later becomes Mapai, the central Zionist movement. His grandmother, Kastner marries Yosef Fischer's daughter, the grandmother, the grandfather, brothers, sisters. In addition to the family, some 388 people from his hometown. Now, after the war, I need not tell you, this became one of the greatest criticisms of Kastner, that he saved family, saved friends. I want to ask you one simple question. Is there anyone sitting in front of me or on the screen who would not save his own family and his own friends? I challenge anyone to say that they would let their own family die, their friends die, and just save, according to the Gemara in Chagiga, you know, the Horiot, we have Sugyas, Talmidei Chachamim, Kohanim, Leviim, Rashi Kahal. We might have a whole order of who to save, right or wrong. Kohen, the Mamzer Talmud Chacham is more important than a Kohen Gadol Amaretz, right or wrong? An open Mishnah? I don't have to go further. Is there anyone? All right. I don't believe this anyone, because it goes against another open Gemara. Adam Karov Eitzel Atzma. One of the shilas that Reb Heschel had to deal with in the corona COVID outbreak, what if you get a medicine to use? Who do you give it to? Yes, the original shilah goes back, Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, penicillin, a limited amount of antibiotics. You'll see with the Satmar Rav when he gets to Israel how his life is saved. It's an unbelievable question. Rav Moshe Paskin, do you give it to who comes first? And other people said about Rav Moshe, he forgot an open Mishnah, an open Gemara. You have a whole chart to go by. Who goes first? Who's more important? It's an unbelievable question. By the way, I defend Rav Moshe, because Rav Moshe was saying that. It's not in a hospital, it's not that you have everyone lined up. You have a patient in front of you now. He's there, he needs it. The fact that he's in a marriage, so what? You're going to tell him, drop dead, and you got to hold on to this penicillin in case a Talmud Chacham comes along 2-3 days later. I defended Rav Moshe. It's a whole correspondence. All right, this was one of the tremendous criticisms of Kastner. But there's something even more. And here I take you back. I don't know if you're aware that in this classroom, Sunday, Monday, it used to be Sunday, Wednesday, then it became Sunday, Tuesday. Now it's Sunday, Monday, and it's all in the morning because I don't have that ability to lecture Sunday evening anymore. I'm more tired. In this classroom, we never repeated a lecture. So I've covered endless topics in halacha and in machshava. If you recall, I gave lectures, I don't know how many years ago, Charlie, you'll see if you were here, on the Belzer Rebbe. And, you know, the whole story of the escape of Reb Arla with Reb Mordechai, his nephew, is an unbelievable story. I actually had a student in Machon Gold in the early 70s, a girl from Brooklyn, and she would daven. Bell's den was in Machne Yehuda. She would go there and daven. You know where they would put her to sit? Next to the Rebbe's mother. The Rebbe, the present Belzer Rebbe's mother. She died a few years ago. She had Amicha Jem Tovim. She survived her husband by many, many decades, Reb Mordechai. And she sat right next to the Belzer Rebbe. And you know why? Her father, who was in America and a man of some means and influence and contacts, played a crucial role in hatching the plan that saved the previous Belzer Rebbe and his brother, the father of the present Belzer Rebbe. And it was a miracle. It was an unbelievable plan. Everything they did to save Belz couldn't work it out. And his whole family, the Nazis took over Hungary, and they worked very, very quickly in killing the Jews. The previous Belzer Rebbe, as you know, his wife and 11 children were wiped out. Nothing was left. And they hatched this plan, and I've told you this many times. Books have been written, both in Hebrew and in English. They dressed the Belzer Rebbe up as a Russian captured general who these Hungarian soldiers were taken to be questioned and debriefed, and his aide-de-camp was his nephew, who is the equivalent of, let's say, a major in the Russian army. They had the uniforms. And there was one tremendous problem, which I told you more than once. Neither of them spoke Russian, and they had to bribe the Belzer officer who played the role, drove the car, and his aide-de-camp, and they risked their lives. I mean, they got paid for it. You know, everyone criticizes Jonathan Pollard. They got paid. I don't know what he got paid. Didn't get paid, but he put his life on the line for the Jewish people. And they, with miracles, got out of Hungary, reached Romania. Romania finally reached Turkey. Turkey Aliyah. Now, when they reached Budapest, some of the Chassidim in Budapest discovered that it's the Belzer Rebbe. And they pleaded with him to speak, to give a drasha. And he and his brother, on the Shabbat in Budapest, where they're stopping over. From there, they're going to continue on their journey. On the Shabbat, the Belzer Rebbe, I don't know if he spoke, he wrote the drasher out, it could be Reb Mordechai delivered it, read the memoirs. And they didn't say a word about what Hitler intended to do, and he didn't say a word about encouraging the Jews, leave, run, leifa weg from Danet. Tutfasman can do what you can, get out, smuggle. Instead, they comforted them, said, that's not good, it'll be good, everything will work out, Hitler will be defeated, you'll all come to Israel. Well, this talk of the Belzer Rebbe until today, you know which literature there is, pro and con. Did he do the right thing? Did he do the wrong thing? And here you have a tremendous question. If anyone can give me a black and white answer, I am meeting someone who is above human. Because a human being, what do you want? Look what my choice is. The Belzer Rebbe and his brother knew their lives were being saved. The Belzer Rebbe and his younger brother, Reb Mordechai. The Belzer Rebbe and Reb Mordechai, he was the Begulita Rav. He was a Rav in Hungary. They knew that Hitler was killing any man, woman, and child, and he was working the death camps and sending them to Auschwitz unbelievably fast in Hungary, even faster than Poland and faster than Holland, etc. So what do you want? They should get up and tell the Jews, you're going to be killed, you're going to be tortured. What could the Jews do? Is there any way to avoid Hitler? Or no? They knew the truth. Tell the truth. Maybe 10% could have figured out how to escape, how to run to the forest, how to hide, how to go to a Goyish neighbor who was a Chas. They just accepted more Gentiles, Chasidim and Talam. Look what we're talking about. In the year 2021, there's still Gentiles being uncovered, Chasidei Umat Olam. And what do you want them to do? And until today, there are people who criticize Belz, criticize the Rebbe. He should have been more forthright. They shouldn't have left them with a feeling of complacency. Or there are others that will say they understood very well only they could be saved. Only a plot like this could be hatched to save them. You come to Rudolf Kastner, if you read just recently with the celebration on the 21st of Kislev, Kislev, so their celebration is Chaf Aleph Kislev. With the celebration of Chaf Aleph Kislev, exactly the same criticisms surfaced. Kastner, I got an email from a Talmud listening, I don't know him personally. He said, how can you mention Kastner Yimach Shmo V'Zichro? Because of him, my parents were killed, my grandparents were killed, all my aunts and uncles were killed. Because the claim is made that Kastner knew exactly what Hitler was doing, which he obviously did. And he bargained for 1,600 Jews. It's like he made a deal with the devil, kill the other hundreds of thousands, and give us 1,600. Or no, it's just the opposite. What could he do? He couldn't save everyone. Hitler was going to do what Hitler was doing. Hitler didn't give a hoot about Rudolf Kastner. But Kastner, at least let's save what we can. And he negotiated with the devil, and he bought out approximately 1,600 plus Jews. today in the world, because of Kastner, there are hundreds of thousands of Jews alive. If you take Sutton already, really hundreds of thousands, not just physically alive, but spiritually alive, and it all goes back to Rudolf Kastner. How do you judge him? What do you say? And this is the heart of the issue. And it's just amazing that everything I said now in class, these arguments began the minute the state of Israel started to function. Remember, 48, 49, no one had the ability to think, to complain, to compare, to shout, to yell. We were caught up in tremendous war, and afterwards, endless immigrants that had to be absorbed. Before 48, you had the DPs. After the war, more DPs came in, and all the Arabs, Jews, running away from the Arab countries. And then, when they started to lift their head a little bit, the machloiket, the controversy over Kastner, and exactly what I said now is what they said then, and exactly what they said then is what they said just a few weeks ago when Satmar got together in New York and celebrated the Rebbe's redemption. These are difficult problems. Now, we have a lot of memoir literature, and there's no question that Kastner married the right girl. The question of marrying the right girl, I've told you, it always comes up in life. I'm actually watching a movie with my wife. I told you, YouTube is unbelievable, but you got to watch movies from the 1930s. They're on a different level than what you have already after World War II. So we're watching a movie. I don't watch the whole movie, all right, every night, but I watch a little. It's not a great movie, but the plot is very simple. A nice, solid boy, not wealthy, whose goal in life is to go to college and have a profession and make a living. He marries a girl. He meets her through her father, who accidentally introduces them. He works for her father, a multi-millionaire already in 1931. Yes, I said it's 90 years ago. It's interesting to see the way they live, the way people look. By the way, men's clothes didn't change at all. He has a single, not a double-breasted suit. I couldn't get over it. It just looks like the way we would look. If I lived in America, I'd be dressing like that. And the girl, wealth on top of wealth, they go to Paris on a honeymoon, and she buys clothes, and daddy pays for everything. Now, did he marry the right girl, yes or no? You follow? You can look at it. Fabulous. He'll never have to work another day in his life. He can devote his whole life to Torah courses, be a clout tour, work for the... I know people like that work. Or no. Marrying this girl broke his spirit. He now becomes what the movie is called, a kept husband. Now, Rudolf Kastner married Joseph Fischer's daughter. His father-in-law was the head of the Zionist. There was a secular left-wing Zionist party, more or less what Mapai would become. And he married, and he becomes by himself, Rudolf Kastner, an important person in the community. And when he has all these contacts through his father-in-law, through his own activities, and his father was a member of the Hungarian parliament, and Kastner is active with his father-in-law in the Zionist movement, and they have these connections, he goes to work against all odds to save whom he can. Now, after the war, he wrote a report for the Zionist, for the Jewish agency, and he writes, I'm quoting, this is what Kastner wrote, I called the train a Noah's Ark because it contained a close section of the Jewish community. And here, you got to give credit, basically it was a Noah's Ark. Outside of family and friends from his hometown, everyone selected was the best it could do to give a feeling of a cross-section of the population. There were rabbis, 40 rabbis. One of them was Rabbi Joel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe, who was the most famous. There were scholars, artists, housewives, peasants, farmers, industrialists, bankers, journalists, teachers, and nurses. The writer, Bela Zlot, was on board. Anyone from Hungary would recognize that name. The psychiatrist, Leopold Zandi, the opera singer, Dezo Ernster, the artist, Istvan Israi, and Peter Monk, who became a businessman in Canada. And the description goes on and on. Now, what's fascinating is the train did not leave Hungary immediately. For whatever reason, we never will know until today. It seemed that Eichmann was ready to go back on his deal, and the train got stopped at Bergen-Belsen. Bergen-Belsen, everyone had to disembark. They were put into a special section. If you want to know what their daily diet was, and this is from the memoir literature, 330 grams of a gray dense bread, 15 grams of margarine, 25 grams of jam, 1 liter of vegetables, mostly turnip soup, 1.5 liters of a coffee substitute, and sometimes cheese or sausage with milk and extra rations for children under 14. All right, this certainly was better than you got in the average concentration camp from the Germans. They were worried stiff because they didn't know what would happen to them. Certain people couldn't go further, certain people, again, you had to make choices, no one knew. It's like Israel today with Corona. No one knows what tomorrow will bring. You didn't have any precedence. There are people who chose not to continue the Kastner train who wind up in Auschwitz. They forfeited their lives, basically. There are other people who were put onto the train. Can anyone tell me from my lectures which family was put onto the train in Bergen-Belsen? They were there and they were scheduled for deportment to Auschwitz, and they had contact with the Jewish organizations that dealt with Kastner, and their, I believe it was their cousin, pleaded with Kastner, add them to the train. Esther Jungreis's family. Rabbi Jungreis, the Rebbetzin, the three children, they were added to the train when it was in Bergen-Belsen. Now, while they were Bergen-Belsen, this is also to our great credit, this went on in the Warsaw Ghetto, etc., under these tremendous, trying conditions, the Jews tried to do their best to educate. You see, with Corona today, if you heard the news, the biggest problem in the country at this minute is that many of the schools are going to be closed down. They go back to Zoom. Now, for me to teach on Zoom at this level here, a whole world is looking at me on Zoom. Some of the most famous people you will imagine are looking at me. Rabbanim, doctors, professors, world-class people. It's not a problem on Zoom at this level of teaching. But tell me, elementary school children, high school children, children who need a Rebbe, and they're crying. I've heard the radio this morning. I heard already the 5 o'clock news, and I went online here in Gris. They're crying. They're back to Zoom. New kids are back to Zoom, an 8-year-old kid. A kid in high school needs a Rebbe to tap him on the shoulders, encourage him. What did we read about Leibel Dulitz yesterday? Students of his testified, he's the most caring Rebbe I ever had. No, Zoom, same thing here. What do you do? So you should know in Bergen Belsen, with all these intellectuals and Rabbanim, they organize classes. Classes for the children, classes for the adults. They had poetry readings, lectures in history, philosophy, and religious education. So, wow. Then in December of 44, the first batch August 1944, they allowed 318 passengers to arrive in Switzerland. In December, reaching Switzerland on Chafalev Tevet, I believe it was December 7th that year, 1,350 passengers. Everyone who got out to Switzerland. And this saved the Rebbe's life. It saved the Jungreis family. It saved Rabbi Yonatan Stiff, who was a Gaon Adir Rav in Budapest, later the Wiener Schule in Williamsburg. When I was growing up, he was one of the most famous. Rabbi Moshe was not even on the map yet, but everyone knew Rabbi Yonatan Steif, Posek, Mufak. Wow. And it worked. They saved them. All right. Life moved on. And as I said to you, by the early 50s, Israel is surviving. By the way, I have to tell you, no one was sure Israel would survive until 56. The Sinai campaign changed the entire atmosphere here. Before the Sinai campaign, we were surviving, but there wasn't confidence in what tomorrow will bring. The Sinai campaign, that we could go to war, that we had an air force, that we could do what we did against the massive Arab armies, that gave the people a lot of self-confidence. And of course, I need not tell you, ultimately, 67 changed the map, and 73 changed the mentality, if you're reading me. Before 73, Kochi v'otzim yadi yasu li et ha'chayol hazeh. Moshe Dayan, like an Elil, what we spoke about yesterday, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Chet, what I quoted yesterday, Moshe Dayan, Golda Meir, oh my, wow, what a disappointment, what a letdown. And that created, you should know, the heart of the Baal Teshuva movement in Israel began after 73. In America, it began after 67. You follow? In America, there, the pride, but they woke up, we're Jews. The Rav, you know, we were overwhelmed. The Rav spoke about this in Kol Dodido Fake, that it creates Jewish feeling among assimilated youth. But in Israel, it was the army. Kol HaKavod L'Tzahal. We came in Aliyah, there were signs all over. Kol HaKavod L'Tzahal. I remember we were in Tel Aviv, in the Mashbir. There were not many big stores in Israel. It was a totally, totally different. Today, when you come in Aliyah, you have to pay Israel, because life here is better. It's on a higher level than America. What's available, everything is kosher. It's, wow, mikvot. I mean, with all our problems, we yell, we shout. But wow. But in 70s, I remember we went to Mashbir. This must be 69 in Tel Aviv. And there was an elevator there. Oh, and then my kids, you know, Israel. And as we're standing there, a general walks out of the elevator. And aloof, everyone salutes. I'll never forget that. Everyone. They were, when I did basic training, I saluted every officer. I played the game. I enjoyed it. They looked at me and these officers were Jews. Then my wife once came home. Malka came home. She was shaking. She had to go to Tel Aviv. Oh, I know why. She had to go to Tel Aviv. She was finishing courses and she was getting a degree in library science, a postgraduate degree. And she had to go for the test in the Binyan Histadrut. So my son-in-law says, he was going to Tel Aviv daily in a big army car with a driver. And there was, when they reached the exit of Jerusalem, there's a place where the Chayalim stand waiting for lifts. And the car stops, my son-in-law jumps out, who's going to Tel HaShomer, where his base is, who's near there. And everyone salutes, you high-ranking officer. They call, and my wife came away, she said, everyone salute. I said, that's the army, you understand? Baruch Hashem, they're well-trained that a Jew can take a ben, that a Jew can salute another Jew is a miracle. That's why we celebrate Yom HaTzmut. You understand? We have to say Hallel. Ashreinu Shezachinu. So, excuse me?
It doesn't happen today.
I'll tell you, the Israeli army, when I did basic training, there were some Russians doing, I remember a guy, Arnold, there was an Edward, my name. And I remember he had been an officer in the Russian army, and here he's doing basic, and he says to me, if this would be Russia, they would execute half of us. But all right, to a certain degree, that camaraderie is very good for the Israeli army, because in a moment of crisis, all the walls fall. It works to our advantage, and, in a moment of crisis, a lower-ranking person can take charge. You know what the halacha is in the army? If everyone is injured or gone, the highest ranker there has to take charge. So you could have a case where it's only a sergeant and he's stepping into a position of command. But we've done it successfully. Listen, Baruch Hashem, we have an army, and I'll tell you the truth. If you want to live al pi halacha, what's your wife's name?
Abigail.
If you want to live al pi halacha, we should carry signs. All Mechalalei Shabbos out of the army. The Gemara in Sota, I'm talking the Rambam, Perek Zayin, Hilchim, right or wrong? Hasach bein tefila letefila. Here the yeshiva boys are claiming, who should serve in the army? The tzaddikim, the shomrei Shabbos. All right, we're not there yet, but we'll get there. We'll get there, Be'ezrat Hashem. We shouldn't have any Mechalalei Shabbos, and we'll let them all in. But you see, Malkiel Greenwald, he was a Mizrahi politician. He was a survivor from Hungary. And he went after Kastner publishing a pamphlet charging him with being a murderer, charging the Israeli government or what preceded them, the Jewish agency, collaboration with the Nazis. And his main complaint was that they didn't make available the knowledge to the Jews in Hungary that the Nazis will kill every last one of you. Do what you can to get out, to sneak away, to hide. And he criticized the Jewish agency. You were killers. Well, by that time, Kastner was working for the government. He had a job, and the government took Greenwald to court. And it became one of the most famous cases in the history of the Israeli judiciary. The judge who handled it on the lower level was Binyamin Halevi. He later, goes to the Supreme Court. But then he was a district judge, and he found Kastner guilty on all charges. It's amazing. Shortly after that, an appeal was made to the Supreme Court. Before they could issue their decision, Kastner was assassinated on the streets of Tel Aviv. The Supreme Court overturned all that Binyamin Halevi had ruled, except for one aspect. I'll go into that in a minute. But the Supreme Court took the point of view, what could Kastner have done? Hitler was Hitler. Jews are going to be killed. Give him credit that he at least saved over 1,600 people and recreated their lives, children, etc., and all that goes with it. Unfortunately, Kastner was not alive to hear this decision. He was dead already. The only part of the original decision of Binyamin Halevi, a lot has been written on this. I mean, this is not simple matters, because there's no black and white here. The only part was in relation to Kurt Becher, B-E-C-H-E-R. Kurt Becher, and again, you talk about problems that, where do we turn? What do we do? What's the truth? What should we have done? Kurt Becher was a mid-ranking SS officer. He was never put on trial because of Kastner. Kastner claimed that Becher was one of the few people that he met who was decent and upright and tried to save as many Jews as possible. Now, who was Becher? Becher was a wealthy German kid from a wealthy home who specialized in horses. That was his family business, that was his knowledge, and he joins the German army and gets involved in the Secret Service division that has to purchase horses. And they send him to Hungary. Becher claimed afterwards he was sent to Hungary to purchase 20,000 horses for the German army. Whatever the reason was, it's not totally believed. Some say Arndt, one of the famous ladies who survived and writes about the Holocaust, she claims he made the story up because it sounded plausible, because this division of the SS would not be prosecuted afterwards at Nuremberg. What he did do, in addition to purchasing horses, he became the money man for the SS. And Eichmann told him to squeeze the Jews in Hungary for as much money as possible. That's how Fischer, that's how Kastner, that's how they got to know him, because he was demanding gold and silver and cash and jewelry, whatever he could squeeze out of the Jews. So they sense that he is a man for whom money speaks. And they negotiated and ultimately bought out 1,600 plus Jews, paying off Becher. Now, after World War II, when they put the Nazis on trial, Kastner testified that Becher did not have evil intent, that he did his best to help Kastner buy out as many Jews as possible. Because of that, Becher was not put on trial, became a prosperous businessman in Germany, headed up many corporations, including the Cologne Handelsgeschäft, which did extensive business with the Israeli government. Halevi found him guilty of saving Becher, who in Halevi's opinion was a criminal, that he let 1,600 Jews out, but he let them out for a very stiff price. And why only 1,600? Why not 3,200? You understand? These are the problems that there's no solution. The Supreme Court upheld Halevi's decision only in relation to Becha. In relation to everything else, they found for Kashna and not for Greenwald. Ultimately, Greenwald was fined, I think it was the equivalent of 1 lira for his accusations, even if he was found to have accused falsely, but the feeling was you can't punish him. There's no right, there's no wrong. This is the Hitler period. Who do you save? How do you save? What do you do? What do you tell? What the responsibilities are for Rabbanim, for communal leaders? Do you tell the people tomorrow you'll be dead, or do you encourage them to live? And this is a very delicate problem. It hits us in many areas of life. One of the greatest examples that Malka and I saw in communist Russia. Again, if you grow up in Israel, grow up in America, grow up in any democracy, it's hard to conceive what communist Russia was like. People in Russia, you rode on the metro, and in Moscow, the metro was just unbelievable. It's one of the great achievements of the Stalin era. You rode on the metro, not a sound. Absolute silence. And we asked why. They're afraid. They're KGB agents, every third person, who knows. You'll say something wrong, someone will squeal on you. Someone will squeal on you if they're not a KGB agent, because they'll be rewarded with fancy food that's not available. You have to understand what Russia was like. You went into a so-called food shop, so you found endless potatoes and endless beets and endless cabbage. There was nothing else. We saw a line all around. No one really worked in Russia. You got your salary no matter what. The middle of the workday, the word went out that oranges have arrived from Morocco. We saw this with our own eyes. A line that went around the block. We asked, we were with the famous refusenik, Elia Essas. Elia, what are they waiting on? What are they waiting for? Oranges. I said, what, are you joking? We come around to the exit from the store. Yvan Stupan is walking out. Each one was allowed to buy 1 kilo of oranges. So you see, there was this constant tension, fear, reward, punishment. What a society. And here these Jews are in refusal. They've lost their jobs. Professors are working as elevator people. If you don't work, you go to jail. That's a parasite. I trust Yomo grew up in the Ukraine. You know what I'm talking about. These were the laws. These were the regulations. And we were amazed. People in refusal. Sirivnikim, refusnikim, and they're living a normal life. I said, aren't you afraid? You speak, you go, you do. And they gave us an answer that we'll never forget. If we stop living normally, we've put ourselves in jail even before we're in jail. And this is a very delicate question. How do you live? What do you do? Should I get up and speak in Russia and tell them you're a bunch of idiots, you're going to be tortured, you're going to be sent to Siberia, hide and don't express your Judaism, or do you get up and say, be proud Jews, and be Ezrat Hashem, it will work out. What do you do? How do you approach? What do we want out of Kasdan? What do you want out of the Belzer Rebbe? Right or wrong? There are two sides to this question. It's not black and white. And take a look. Yuli Edelstein, who's Makatova to me until today, which he has reason to be Makatova. We smuggled in food, the money, to bribe his jailers, we went into the Beryuska, we bought whiskey, whatever. His first wife, she should rest in peace, was a great lady. Tanya, she died young, Zichrona Levracha, and smuggled it in, and they give the jailers, let them bring in with the kosher food for him, and go look where he's at today. Head of the parliament in Israel, one of the most famous politicians, Yuli Edelstein. Hard to believe what he went through. But what do? Do you give up the battle? Do you hide? Do you run? Or do you stand proud? You may have to suffer, but ultimately it will work out. All right. This machlokas haunts us until this very day. I'm quoting to you from Haaretz, their English articles, December 20th, 2018. A very balanced article. And it tells you what's going on. Kislev, 21st, and all the Jews come together, come to celebrate. And they say there's no consensus. Here's what Eichmann said about Kastner. Quote from Eichmann. Again, do you believe Eichmann? This is when he was captured and interviewed by a German newspaper, a Dutch Nazi journalist. And he quotes quotes Eichmann. Kastner had agreed to help keep the Jews from resisting deportation and even keeping order in the collection camps. If I would close my eyes and let a few hundred or a few thousand young Jews immigrate to Palestine. In other words, it was a trade-off. And Eichmann says it was a good bargain. All right? Do you have to? Was it a good bargain? Could he have done? Is Eichmann telling the truth? Did Eichmann have a vested interest in this? Perhaps to show that he wasn't as bad as you think because bad Jews cooperated with him? Then you talk about the Jews he saved. Well, among the 1,600, 150 seats on the trains were auctioned off to well-off Jews. All right? Could you imagine the criticism? Could you imagine if we're captured and we have to surrender five people and five people can walk out alive? And we're going to say, well, the highest bidders can walk out alive. On the other hand, what was that money used for? Brecher insisted, Eichmann insisted, $1,000 per head for each Jew. You have 1,600, approximately 30, 35 Jews, times $1,000. No? $1,000, 1944 money. What's it worth today? I don't know. $25,000, $30,000, who knows? Do we have that type of money? Yeah, today I have it. I'm proud to tell you. Believe me, in the 70s and the 80s, I didn't have it. The Abigail, get the message when people say to me, Aliyah's hard, I laugh at them. Aliyah's fabulous. Yeah, you got to struggle, but ultimately, God rewards you. Charlie, am I right or wrong? What do you say? Charlie came in Aliyah, he didn't know where he came to Israel. He wasn't even a Zionist. He's raised in Kilat Adat Yeshurin. And Harvard sent him here to do postgraduate work at Weizmann with Professor Katziam. I have it right. And I quote Charlie from the time I met Professor Katziam, later becomes president of Israel, I could never leave. Understand? We don't need Zionists here. We need Jews who love Eretz Israel. That's what we need. After 2,000 years of exile, that we can come home. When I put on my army uniform in Bakum, Tel HaShomer, Basis Klita U'Miyun, and the girl, the little chayelet, gives me the uniform, and I put it on, I make a shechayanu. And she looked at me, I don't know if she understood. I made a shechayanu b'shem u'malchut. Baruch Hashem. So I have one grandson, a career officer. Not a small matter. Gentlemen, We needed the money. Who's going to give it? The poor people? The Lower East Side people? Pardon me, Vic Snow, for putting down the Lower East Side? Or the Jews from Teaneck? The Jews from Lawrence? What do you say, Shlomo? You understand? So you see, with all this criticism, there are two sides to the coin. And they celebrated, they celebrate tremendous Fabringen. The politicians come out the day the Rebbe was saved. Satmar was saved. Hasidus was saved. A new world was born. Now, I want to tell you something. You can't believe what the archives come up with. What you have available on the internet. This just was posted recently. I don't know if you can see it. These are the lists of who was put on the Kastner train from Hungary, from Budapest. And here you see on the list, can't be denied, Kastner, his family, and it tells you everyone is from, the people from his village, the Satmar Rav is right here, and Rabbi Yonatan Steif, the greatest Rabbanim. How did that list survive? It wound up in Romania. Rabbi Moshe Rosen, who was the Rav of the Romania, and a lot has to be said about him. He's one of the great Jews of our times. He was Rav in a communist country, but Romania and Hungary were the least oppressive to the Jewish people to religion. They tolerated it. And Rav Moshe Rosen worked hand in hand with the government. Ultimately, they reached a deal with Israel. Any Jew who wanted to leave Romania was basically allowed to leave. The Israeli government bought him out. There was a price for each Jew, X thousands of dollars. You got to give credit what the Israeli government did. And I've told you more than once, I worked in the Mossad. I know the Mossad people. It's not like politicians. I saw people, not all were from obviously, but their total existence was dedicated to saving and helping the Jewish people. With my own eyes, ears, mind, and heart, I dealt with these people. I worked with these people. You got to give credit. They bought, this was done quietly. Jews were bought out of Romania one by one by one. This was Reb Moshe Rosen. And he had these documents and he made them available. Today you can actually check and recheck anyone who writes a memoir. And a lot has been written. Yad Vashem has published a great deal. All the names mentioned you find on the list. Okay. My dear students, we're now about to enter the big leagues. Until now, we've been in AAA. Yomo is so Americanized when I say AAA, he's smiling, you understand? He reached the point where he knows baseball better than I do. But not the Yankee history, Yomo. That I'm still the master. Okay. We've reached the big leagues. What we're touching upon here, halachically, totally forbidden. I take you back, Ben, if you're smart, take off 7 years, go to YU Torah, and listen to my shiurim from decades ago. I spent 5 years on the responsa literature of the Holocaust. 5 good years. They're probably the best shurim I ever gave, outside of a Reuven. Maybe they were better. One of the greatest problems, it's a Mishnah, it's a Tosefta, it's a Psak of the Rambam. The goyim knock on the door of this classroom, surround us with guns, Chesky. All of us. And they say, give us one Jew to kill and we'll let the rest of you live. What's the halacha? Can anyone tell me? We all have to die rather than surrender one Jew. Right or wrong? Right or wrong? We're on a tiyul, I'm teaching, in, for the sake of argument, Mechon Gold, Mechola, Midrashet Maria. I taught women 31 years. You're on a tiyul. Whole group of women. Surrender one woman to us for legal purposes or we'll kill you all. Not allowed to surrender. Chas v'chalila. And this raises that tremendous question. How were we allowed to cooperate looking at this problem from a halachic viewpoint? I'll give you where to find all the sources either this week, next week. I just wonder, what's going on here? You're surrendering, you're saving 1,600 Jews and basically surrendering hundreds of thousands to be killed. And halacha lemaisa, you're not even allowed to surrender one Jew to save 100,000.
You're not surrendering anybody. You're not affirmatively surrendering anybody. They are doing what they're doing.
No, a Jew has a right to run away. But you're talking about Kastner cooperating and preparing lists, and what's the implication? But this problem is much worse. I'll show you, it's much... It's the last issue I spoke about face-to-face with Mori Rebbe, Absalveitchik, the Rav, 1983. I'll give you sources, but I want to begin at the beginning. I want to show you a source that no one has called to our attention. Mossad Rav Kook. They decided to come out with a modern commentary on Tanakh, which would be totally in consonance with tradition. I remember when it began, Dat Mikram referring to, it took many years, people were cynical, how can you do it? Either it's scientific or it's halachic or Masoretic, but how do you combine the two? And I need not tell you that the Dat Mikra is one of the greatest achievements in modern day Israel. No one calls attention with all our tension and all our problems and all our taxes and all our wars and all our soldiers. What we have produced in scholarship, it makes the free world, America, England and Canada look like child's play. Talmudic Encyclopedia, Otsah HaPoskim, Shmirat Shabbat Gehilchata, and all the halachic works that follow in that format. Dat Mikra. All right. Tell me, what are we reading about in Chumash? We just finished Sefer Bereshit. And Yosef HaTzadik. And he accuses the brothers of being spies. And he wants to put them all in jail. And they make a deal with him. We'll surrender one. The rest of us will go back and bring the food to our father. And who do they surrender? Shimon. Tell me, you have a right to pick out one brother to save the others? Isn't this exactly the most delicate, terrible, heartbreaking problem that comes out of the Holocaust? Kastner is a small example. The Kovna Rav, will come to that. The Kovna Ghetto, the Devar Avraham. Give us a list of the sick and the ill. or we'll kill everyone. Wow. Shimon, how do you select him? Look in Tzedak Mikra, Breshit Membet, Pasuk Yutet. It's the third volume on Bereshit, Amud Kuf Nun Hey. And the editor of Dat Mikra, who wrote the commentary on Bereshit, Yehuda Kiel, K-Yud Lamed, Matan, make believe you know the name so the ignorant pass for the wise. Yehuda Kiel. Mark, where did I talk about yesterday? Where have I davened 6:30 minyan Shabbos morning since 1969 in Ohel Rivka? And I told you yesterday Yehoshua Blau was sitting one row in front of me. Professor Blau, Pras Yisrael, Rambam, Tshuvat. Two rows in front of me was Yehuda Kiel. Do you know who Matanya Engelman is? The Mevaker HaMedina? He's in the papers day in and day out. He is Yehuda Kiel's grandson. Okay? Married to a girl who grew up in my building. The daughter, granddaughter of the Mandelbaum Gate. She was a Mandelbaum. I believe her first name is Abigail, actually. Yeah, Abigail Mandelbaum. Yehuda Kiel writes in his commentary, Shepsikato shel Yosef tomenet b'chuba b'yachil chatit nusamrit sheket rida et chachmei Yisrael u'poskot ledorotayim ad ledor hashoa v'ad b'klau siya shel b'nei adam shamru lehem goyim tenu lenu echad mechem v'narog oto v'yimlad narog et kuchem Yeharei kulam v'lo yimseru nefesh echad b'Yisrael. Tosefta, Zuckermandel edition, Trumot, Perek Zion, Mishnah Chaf. My dear students, here you have it. Yosef HaTzadik? How could he select one brother, the rest die? Give me Shimon, you're Jewish? Surrender? Wow. And here maybe you could come out of it with, all right, he was choosing one he will choose. But translated into modern times, and he says, this problem has bothered the scholars by Yahu Chatit Musarit that Chachmei Yisrael Uposkov all the way down to Rakefet in his lectures in Grush decades ago. How do we do this? Dar HaShoah. And let me go one step further and end off. I'm whetting your appetite. Next week I'll bring you a little further. The Kovner Ghetto gives you what I've written about it, just the sources, because to start doing it would take another year. And the Rav, and my final face-to-face conversation with the greatest person I knew in my life, Mori Rebbe. Well, tell me, who was Yehuda Kiel? Why does this trouble him so much? I knew him. Know him quite well. I mean, now it's quite a minyan, Ohel Rivka 6:30. That's where Professor Jacob can't stop him. The same minyan. We got Birchat Kohanim from him every Shabbat. So I went to the Wikipedia. And I got my answer. He was born in St. Petersburg in Russia. His parents smuggled themselves out of Russia. They got the Panovich in Litva where they could give him a Torah education. He got a fabulous education, both a Torah education, a general education, active in Bnei Akiva, and in 1935 he came an Aliyah. Shortly afterwards, his sister joined him in Palestine, and they went on to very successful lives here. Studied at the Hebrew U, made a panasa. He was the maskal of Bnei Akiva, worked for Bnei Akiva, worked for Mossad Rav Kook. The rest of his family was totally wiped out by Hitler. His mother, his father, all their siblings, all that survived were Yehuda and his sister, who had come in Aliyah in the mid-30s. So you can understand how the Holocaust and these decisions, who you choose, what you do, in his case, he and his sister chose, so there's no Shaila. But wow, what a haunting question. Surrender Jews, so we'll save Jews. And in the Holocaust, nowhere did this come up as sharp as in the Kovna ghetto, Kovna, where I come from, my Yichus, Rabbi Revel, Kalvariski, my mother's mother, were all from Kovna. And who was the Rav of Kovna, the last Rav before the Holocaust? Rav Avram Dover, Kahana Shapiro, the Dva Avraham, one of the greatest students, Rabbanim, Poskim, to come out of Volozhin. Before Rav Chaim, he was a Posek Mufak. Dva Avraham. Who gave Mori Rebbe Smicha? The Dva Avraham. What did the Dva Avraham have to say about Mori Rebbe in the famous letter he wrote? The spirit of his grandfather Reb Chaim rests upon him. That's what the Kovna Rav wrote. And boy, I hit my Rebbe over the head. Rebbe, how do you relate to the psak of the Kovna Rav in 1942? If it's against an open Tosefta, an open Sugya and Shas, an open Rambam, give the Nazis, Yimach Shmam, the list of the infirm and old, so we can save the others. My dear students, we were traveling on a train with the Satmaruv. We were going from Hungary to Palestine, ultimately we'll wind up in New York, and we derailed the train we're traveling on, and we moved sideways today. And we're dealing in an honest fashion with Kastner. People curse him, people bless him. It goes on until today. I leave you free to take your choice and stand on whatever side of Kastner you wish. But please understand, this problem is deep and real, and it could be a human being cannot solve it. Adam Korev Etzel Atzmo. That's the way God created the world. And sometimes we have to choose. I end off by just telling you, my dearest friend was Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Groner, Professor Groner, died, must be 10 years ago already. I'm not that old, but I've outlived a few good generations of great people. At least I think I'm not that old, or at least in the mornings I'm not that old, that's for sure. Elliot was my student also about 50 years ago, and some of the people listening here also, wow, going back many decades. And I'll tell you what happened. I used to daven at the Kotel every Friday night, you know, until my kneecaps gave out in me. For 46 years, I didn't miss a minyan at the Kotel Friday night. And in 1981, when I got back from Russia, I'm walking back from the Kotel with Tzvi Groner. Now, Tzvi and I could beat up on each other. There were no punches pulled. At the end of the day, Shas and Paiskin won out, but we always had different opinions. So, and then Tzvi was my Sheirim and the Lubavitcher Rebbe that had so much praise for Lubavitch. They told me the best lectures ever given on the Rebbe, and I'm an outsider, but it was through Tzvi, through his uncle, Nagel Groner. I knew the inside. So I told Tzvi, you know, we got to do everything we can to get the Essas family out of Russia. So Tzvi says to me, why them? Why not this one, that one? And I told Tzvi that if you try to save a million people, you save no one. If you try to save one, you may save, which we did ultimately. And why him? Why do you choose? And that's the problem. Why do you choose him and not the other Jew? And I can only tell Tzvi it's a gut reaction, a human reaction. I can't spell it out black and white. But he's the one we met, we were overwhelmed with what he did in Moscow, the family. Get him out, he's been in refusal so many years. And this concept of choice, it lingers on. At times, it's very difficult because the halacha is clear, not clear. At times, the human instinct plays a big role. And we'll pick up next week exactly where we left off. I wouldn't miss this coming Sunday shiur for all the new pills that are being prepared in America that Israel has bought, that if you come down with COVID, you take the pill and you walk away dancing to the Rebbe's shiur. I wouldn't miss Sunday shiur. Sunday, you'll see the Ramban and Rav Menashe Klein does, and it's basic Yiddishkeit, way beyond sports. Then I'm going to take a side trip, Tzva Hagana Yisrael, with a very interesting problem that comes up, and a machlokes once again, Rav Menashe Klein and Rav Moshe Feinstein. My dear students in front of me, are there any questions? Yes, Ben.
What the Belz Rebbe, that Shabbos, either he spoke or he wrote out, someone else spoke.
Reb Mordechai, read it.
Was the area where he was, is it already under German control?
Oh yeah, this was Budapest. This was the Germans were controlling Hungary, but it was a little bit freer than Poland. On the other hand, they worked much quicker in Hungary. Churchill called it the greatest crime in human history. How many hundreds of thousands were deported and killed from Hungary within a few months?
Was there an element of potentially that he would have risked his own escape if he would have created a turmoil?
Oh, yeah, sure. No, absolutely.
So maybe you could address the fact that we have certain great rabbis who...
No, but say that that's... With the Belzer Rebbe. By the way, you know my wife is a Belzer from her yichus on her father's side, on her mother's side she's a Rushiner, but Kanayin Haran. Our kids are all good Israelis. They don't know what the Litvish and Rushin. They're good religious Zionist Israelis of all types of religious Zionism. If you understand this. And I only, my role is to try to inculcate within them a feeling for the Haredim, that because they're so angry at them, they don't, you know, they're 70, yeah, they give you a whole list, and they have to understand they're afraid to come out of the ghetto because they see what happened to us when we came out of the ghetto. So we have to be the role model, and we have to raise tzaddikim, lamdanim, poskim, Gedolei Yisrael, Gedolei Yirat Hashem, Ahavat Hashem, set the example. And we live in the Western world, yes. We make a living. We produce. I have one grandson who will get pras Bitachon Yisrael. They won't even be able to boast about him because they won't be able to mention his name. And he learns Daf Yomi among other grandsons. Baruch Hashem, let me not talk about my children. Let me talk about my students better. What you're touching upon, first of all, I have a manuscript of, it's probably in printing out 100 pages on this very topic. I have a minor addendum to it that's already in print, 35 pages. Mark, thanks for sitting here and keeping an eye. Thank God everything went well today. It'll be published in a 30th Yahrzeit volume for the Rav that's being edited by Mendy Goldman, Rabbi Mendy Goldman. If you know Rabbi Mendy Goldman, tell him should give you a copy of the manuscript. I allow you to see the 35 page. It'll answer your question. But the answer to your question is Hester Panim. No one understood the Holocaust. No one knew what would be. Some people made the right choice. Some people made the wrong choice. But you can't criticize them. It was Hester Panim. And Hester Panim doesn't only mean the average Shlomazel. It means the greatest Jews alive, too. Hester Panim for all of us. I'm only alive. I have a great-grandson named in memory of my grandfather, Noam Moshe. You know why he's named Moshe? My grandson spoke at the Brit. I think I was Sontag, actually. My grandson spoke at the Brit, and he said he was overwhelmed what I wrote in Washington. My grandfather Moshe Zev, my grandparents, my father's side, both came to America teenage, all my four grandparents came here teenage kids, not married. And he wanted to go back. He was so lonely. He saved up money. He booked passage, 1904. And he gets a telegram from his parents not to come back. Funya, that's the Tsar, has drafted you for the army, the Russo-Japanese War, 1904-05. And that's why he stayed in America, to avoid the war. So imagine, had he gone back very happily, his parents, no one knew, no one could understand, no one could predict. But you asked a very good question, and that question has to do with Hashkafa, and there's a lot to talk about. A lot will hit upon with the Satmarov, with his thinking, his viewpoint. A lot that will hit upon in that very last lecture when we'll refute him, Be'ezrat Hashem. But right now, look at my piece on my Rebbe. It's entitled Joseph and His Brothers in Relation to Theodor Herzl and Zionism. And it's the most important I've written, but what's not yet ready is even more important. That's already the totality. But we'll get there. I have to work. I'm working now on Rabbi Belkin. I don't want to start yet with putting it into a computer program. We have to work back and forth with corrections, etc., etc. All right, I want to say to the wonderful people in front of me, until we meet again in health and happiness, das vedanya. Open it up to the world. Let's see if there are any questions. You see, everyone can see Mark now. It's unmuted. Yeah, are there any questions from around the world?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why didn't Eichmann just keep the money and then kill all the Jews? I have a guess, but I
want you to know, when the train stopped in Bergen-Belsen, they suspected that Eichmann was knifing the Jews. But I'll tell you, my own guess, and you'll see if we're saying the same thing, is that by that point Eichmann knew that Hitler was going to lose. So he figured by saving these Jews, it would help him later to claim he was a good man, only following orders, and when he could do something on his own, he saved 1,600 plus Jews. That's what I would guess. But I don't...
It could also be he was thinking of the future. Maybe he can sell another 1,600, get more and more money.
And I don't know if time was left. By that time in 1944, that's why they're amazed that Hitler used all his energy to kill so many Jews in Hungary when he was losing the war. He should have put energy into fighting the Allies in France, etc., and he did not. It's a sad story. Anyone from Hungary, you see what's very sad is in 244, they actually believed they would be saved. The Hungarians, the Romanians, they thought that there it would not be so terrible. And in Hungary, Dafka, the government was anti-Semitic, but it wouldn't give the Jews the Hitler to kill them wholesale. Hitler finally conquered Hungary, and then he did what he wanted. So there's something to be said for that thinking that they would come out of it alive. But it's very sad. We saw the results. And again, it's an open question. Did we do well to bargain with Eichmann? What were our alternatives? And it's an open question.
Rabbi?
Yes. Yeah.
Go ahead. Two things. One is I heard just recently that the reason why Hitler invaded Hungary, because they were actually very close in relationship, but they were concerned that the Hungarians were going to flip sides to the Russians because they were more scared of the Russians than the Nazis. Therefore they attacked Hungary. That's a side point. But I'd always heard, and especially from the more Haredi Jews that I've met over the years, of their hatred for Medina Israel, and of course, if you read Perfidy by Ben Hecht, you'll see clearly that that the majority, overwhelming majority of people that Kastner saved were Zionists, were left Zionists. It's true that he had, obviously you have to answer about the Rebbe, Satmar Rebbe, how he was included in that, but everyone knows the famous dream story that the wife of Catherine had a dream, etc., etc.
His father-in-law had a dream.
Everyone's time is that Catherine saved.
I understand.
The leftist Zionist didn't care about Orthodox Jews.
Right. He saved, not leftist Zionist, he saved the Zionists, and. Can you blame him? He represented the Jewish agency. It's not simple. I got a call yesterday, they're doing some survey on Jerusalem, the mayor, and I told them that I cannot vote for anyone who is not proudly a Shomer Torah and Mitzvah. So you say to me, so you don't vote for this one, you don't follow, and they ask me about Berkowitz. Berkowitz is, I understand, a wonderful person. Nachum Lamb knows him, but he's not openly a total Shomer Torah Mitzvah. I can't vote for him. But I can't fault Kastner for that. I know what the Haredim say he did, but he saved 40 Rabbanim. He saved the Esther Jungreisen family. Give credit for what he did say, but okay, it's an open question. There's no black and white here, in my humble opinion. And you'll see what the Rav had to say next week. We'll quote Rebbe, not the lowly Rakefet, but the great Moria Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. Okay,
Rebbe,
yeah.
I think Kastner probably had a big problem that he couldn't in the 1950s. He couldn't stand up in court and say, yes, I did all of this, but you have to understand what was going on. You know, you have to understand it was the middle of the Holocaust, and you know, he didn't tell the truth. You know, he couldn't say, I bargained with them, I gave them money, because the whole country was, you know, oh, you're a capo, you're doing this, you're doing that. Like, it was a crime. You know, people went to jail in the 50s for doing this.
Right, the capos went to jail.
And he would have gone to jail had he admitted what he had done. So he ended up, he lied a lot. I don't know if he lied or if he didn't tell the whole truth. You know, so basically the charges against him were true. But, you know, you couldn't say, the 6 million people being killed. It was a problem.
Binyamin Halevi, Taka, said what you said. But the Supreme Court took the attitude, what could he have done otherwise? And at least he saved 1,600 plus. And as far as choosing, everyone has to choose. I don't believe there's a person alive who's normal who would not save his parents, his brothers, his siblings, his aunts, his uncles. The chevra he grew up with in Kew Gardens Hills and the chveis, he played dice with them in the mikveh. You follow? This was the chevra, he drank a l'chaim, etc., etc. it's an open question. You'll see next week. I'll give you more material. All right. Is there anyone else with a question? Because we have to sign off. There's another class coming in. All right. I want to thank everyone for their participation. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Be'ezrat HaNotein L'Yav Koach, Das V'Danya. Bruchim to you. Bruchim to you. Bruchim to you. Okay.